This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Hello, everybody. Chris Landry here for the Tuesday, June 11th edition of the Landry Football Podcast as we are getting further and further into the month of June, heading towards mid-June. And a lot to cover, too, today. Going to talk a little bit about the Texas GM situation. So we're going to talk a little bit about a couple of the coordinator hires that that we think will have an impact in this college football season. So we're going to get into that a little bit. And we're going to talk a little bit about free agents, remaining free agents, in terms of how you deal with that at this point into your roster. So a lot to get to today. The main thing we're going to do is continue our X's and O's series. No position in all of sports commands as much attention, as much hysteria, as much of, everybody thinks they has the answers than the quarterback position. Well, we're going to take you through soup to nuts about that position and how the process takes place through the eyes of a quarterback. So what we're going to do is we're going to tell you a little bit about preparing. We're going to tell you about making the decisions pre-snap. We're going to do everything. We're going to get to that today, and then we're going to take you post-snap. That's how much detail there is. We're not going to have time to get through even everything probably pre-snap, but we're going to take you through as much as possible. What goes on with the decisions and how the decisions are made? We're going to get through all that for you today. So remind you of what's going on at LandryFootball.com. We've got our film breakdowns, college programs, NFL teams. We're working our way through it, working our way through the tape. Going to get as much of that as possible for you. Get you through the whole process. Get you ready for the football season. You know, in a way that's a little bit different, a little bit more sophisticated way inside the film room, evaluating of rosters. That's what we're doing this time of year. When you look at it and think about it, it's we're evaluating rosters. Who has what? How the players grade at the college level and at the certainly with the NFL rosters, how players graded out this past year. So we give you a lot to chew on as you get ready for the football season, no doubt. And it gives you a good feel for kind of where teams stack up, where there's some areas that need to be improved upon. All of that, I think, is very, very pertinent. So we've got a lot to get to today. A reminder, if you haven't joined us at LandryFootball.com, we invite you to do so. We think it's a great opportunity to become involved. A lot of free stuff. You can listen to this podcast, all the podcasts, free on LandryFootball.com. But you can get the Inside the Film Room analysis by becoming a member. Less than a magazine subscription. How about $49 for 1 year? That'll take you through everything that we're doing this time of year. It'll take you through the entire football season, the film breakdowns. It'll take you through next free agency period, next draft period, next year, all the way to next year, calendar year-wise at this time. So it's a great way to get involved the whole process here at LandryFootball.com. So check out the scouting season sale and take advantage of it today. Okay, we had a couple of situations this offseason, most recently in Houston with the Texans firing their general manager, Brian Gain. Of course, the Jets made their move recently with Mike Maccagnan and got a lot of questions about and again, if you have a question, you can send us one at LandryFootball.com, hit contact Chris. How unusual is it? Well, it's unusual, but I want to take you a little bit through the process, and you've heard me describe it before, the importance of the general manager-head coach relationship. There's a lot put into, well, this guy is the decision maker, and this guy answers to that guy. That's fine. There's certainly a direct hierarchy in an organization, which must be followed. But if you have a relationship where the coach and the personnel guy, however the titles match, if they don't gel, if they don't work well together, if they don't both have real good qualities to evaluate and coach and develop, then it's not going to work. And it's not always what you think. In the Jets situation, it was a case of Adam Gase not very comfortable in Mike Maccagnan's ability to evaluate players. And his philosophy is a little bit more towards, you know, we need to make splashes, whereas a coach understands what the value is of a player, and they didn't see eye to eye, and it took them through the draft and free agent process to determine that. That move could have been made, as the critics will say, should have been made a lot sooner prior to the draft. Well, why didn't you do it before? Well, very simply, because they didn't know one another before. Adam Gase didn't come in and off with your head. He wanted to at least see how things would play out. And it's one thing to go ahead and remove a coach at the end of the football season. Sometimes you have to make the move midseason, but for the most part, it's better to make the move at the end of the year. That's why most of the moves are made from a coaching standpoint. Well, from a personnel standpoint, general manager, personnel director, the time to make the move is really not prior to the draft or free agent process. It's after, because that's where you can determine how things are going. And so that's the reason why the situation took place in New York. Brian Gainey is certainly not very long in the Texans organization. And people will say, well, can't get along with Bill O'Brien. You got personality problems. Folks, that's not always what it is. Everyone makes these assumptions in the media without, I'm like, you don't know. You're not in there. Well, I heard this. I heard that. It's most of that stuff BS anyway. It could be that they didn't have the right vision, but let me explain this. Brian is somebody that Bill O'Brien knew. It doesn't necessarily mean that they don't get along, that they don't like each other as people. I think that is often the assumption. Well, they don't get along. They butted heads. It was a power struggle. It's not often that at all. It's a case of some guys are just not very good at their job. And sometimes, you know, coaches have a feel a little bit for other coaches, but they don't have as good of a feel for personnel people, and vice versa. That's why, you know, my background in both coaching and scouting, I call upon those several times a day, every day, the experiences there, because they're different. They're connected, but they're different, and you can't always see the same things from the prism of just one side or the other. Doing both helps you get a view of what the job is on the coaching side, what the job is on the personnel side, and how it works together. And quite simply, it's not always the power struggle. It is, quite frankly, the opposite. It is, okay, you're running things in Houston. Bill O'Brien's making the decisions, but he can't evaluate the players in free agency and the draft all year long because he's coaching the team. When it comes time to get ready for the draft, yeah, they're involved in it, but they're taking the basic information that's being done by the personnel head, the GM, the personnel department. And if that's not being set up correctly, it's kind of like setting up a table. Well, you can only set up the table with the food that you've cooked. You know, a little too late to be ordering out for pizza at the last minute. Yeah, I sit down at the table. It's time to eat. And sometimes guys just are not very good at their job and maybe get the opportunity. And I think that one of the things you would look at is, okay, let's go ahead and say, you've got a situation where you're on the same page, but if there's not a proper evaluation, is not the groundwork being done as well as you need to do it, well, then the basic concept of how you're going to go about making your decision is flawed. So you're only as good as the information, your evaluations. And if you don't, it's not that you don't, not on the same page, is that you can be on the same page, but if you're not good enough at evaluating, then it hurts you. And this is where the biggest problem is. Look, I'm going to tell you something. If you're really, really good as an evaluator and you're really, really good as a coach, you can figure these things out. The whole not on the same page, butting heads is very overrated. What normally happens is just some people are not as good at their jobs, and there's flaws, there are holes in the system. And so, you know, and it's sometimes very hard for people to understand this, because for players, people have a general idea of a player struggling. If you're not well coached, you're losing, people have a pretty good idea that, you know, coaching's not real good or really good. But behind the scenes in the scouting world, people don't know who are good scouts and who are not. They know the results of the draft, but they don't know who's responsible for what. Those things are critical. Those things are critical to the success of understanding where the problems lay. And if you're inside the building, you know where the problems are a lot more than on the outside of the building. So just keep that in mind, that good decision, bad decision, the decisions are based on different information on the inside than on the outside. I also wanted to address a little bit, we're having some, you know, a few little free agent signings trickling in, not a whole lot of stuff that's going on in that regard, but there's a few little things that happen, like Saints signed Kayvon Webster yesterday, and get asked, you know, kind of what the process is. Why does it take so long for some of these guys? Well, keep in mind that you're constantly evaluating your roster. And as you look at it, you are constantly looking at how you want to improve each position. You go through your camps, you see where you're a little bit short, and you kind of compare what you have, a young guy versus a guy that's out there that's still available in free agency. So you'll look at it and you'll say, okay, you know, have your personnel meetings, and you have those every day at mini camp, and you go over kind of where you are and who's out there, and you go over your grades, and obviously, relatively speaking, you know, you see what the costs are and all those things. You look at in great detail. There are not a lot of guys, but there's some guys that are still out there that still have some value. And I think that the longer they're out there, the price comes down a little bit. That factors in when, you know, when you have multiple teams that are competing for a player, the price of the player goes up. When you have a little more time and not as many options, then, you know, then you're dealing with a situation where the supply and demand factor is in your favor. They're not getting a lot of good offers. They're not getting what they had hoped, and therefore you get a guy maybe at a little bit better price. So you're constantly working your what you call your ready list, guys that are on your board that you would be interested in. The other thing that you do, you'll bring in guys for workouts at this time. Guys that you feel has some value that could help you. Maybe you don't have a spot for him today. Maybe he's a veteran that you'd rather spend this time working with your young guys and developing them. But you'll bring a guy in with the idea that, look, we think you can play, think you can help us. We're not going to make a move on it now, but, you know, we're very interested, and we're going to talk with the agent about maybe doing something. We'll see how things play out. We think you can be a good fit here, and here's why. And we, you know, maybe even bring a guy in, maybe even sign him, and you get them comfortable with your system. You will even talk to them a little bit about, you know, what you do, how you do it. They may have a familiarity with your system and say, look, we're interested. We'd like to bring you in. And so we'd like to keep you in mind and keep you ready. We don't feel you need as much practice time now, but, you know, we could call you later. And you kind of lay the groundwork of a recruiting pitch so that final cuts, fourth week of the season, whatever the case may be, the player's still out there. You need to add a guy. you've done the groundwork. If you've signed him and maybe he spent a little time with you in one of your mini camps, OTAs, he has familiarity with what you're doing. And then again, you can call upon him at a later date and have a better feel. He has a better feel for what you're doing, and you have a better feel for him so that you can call upon him. And, so we want to make sure that you get a good feel for the whole situation. And then based on that decision, when it's time that you need them, then you can bring them in, and it's a little bit more of a seamless transition. So a couple of things in mind. A couple of other things I wanted to mention, too. Wanted to go into some coordinators in college that I think can have an impact. As I study spring practice tape and go over film notes and go over a few little film cut-ups from last season, some guys that I think could have an impact, and I'm very curious to see how much of an impact this year, this season in the college game. The first guy is Alex Greenidge of Oklahoma. Did a nice job at Ohio State. He was co-coordinator with Greg Schiano. Didn't have a really good year, but this guy did a great job at Washington State. And I think playing good situational defense to complement with what they do on offense makes Alex Greenidge the most intriguing coordinator hire this offseason. I think it could work really well. I don't think that this Oklahoma defense is going to be great because I don't think they have great personnel, but I think they can be better situationally. I think that they've got to approach maybe to the level defensively where Texas is, because I think Texas right now, of the premier two programs in the Big 12, has a little bit better. They're a little bit of an edge defensively, personnel-wise, and schematically. I also think offensively it would help them to be a little bit more patient with the running game and kind of compress games a little bit more. But I think he will have a big impact for Oklahoma. I'm curious to see what Rich Rodriguez is going to do at Ole Miss in the read option offense. They've lost some big-time receivers, but I think that's interesting. I think Dan Enos of Miami is going to be very interesting. He does a good job with quarterbacks. He's going to have his hand full. He doesn't have as much talent at Miami as he had at Alabama, obviously. So those things are really intriguing to me as well. Jim Chaney of Tennessee is a really good coach. I think he's got good balance as a play caller. I think he's got good balance with the run and the pass. I think that Georgia wanted to do things a little bit differently on offense, so I think it's fair that they were looking to maybe move on, but I think it's a good get for Tennessee, and I think it's one of the more intriguing hires. So those are just a handful of guys. There are others out there, Kendall Briles and Andy Ludwig at Utah and Graham Harrell at USC, Phil Longo that's coming in for Mack Brown at North Carolina. There's some others that are intriguing, but those are some guys, just some that kind of jump out at me that are really intriguing. All right, let me get to a couple of questions here, and then we're going to get into discussing playing the quarterback position, the X's and O's of that. Jacob asks about the Saints and the acquisition of Jared Cook. And he wants to know why is he on so many different teams in his 15 injuries. Jacob has been the biggest reason why. Jarrett's been a really good player when he's been healthy. He's really good with the Raiders. I think reliability in terms of health is a fair criticism. I don't know if he's going to go through a season healthy for the Saints. And if he doesn't, then all the excitement is going to be for naught. We don't know that, but there's been a history there, and that's been the biggest reason. He's a big play guy. I think consistency, even when he's been healthy, has been a little bit of an issue. He'll disappear for stretches. He'll get a little bit lazy in his route running. Where I think it has a chance to be really successful is the fact that he is in a very good offense that will get him the football, and he's with a very demanding play caller and offensive coach in Sean Payton and an equally demanding quarterback that really is going to challenge these guys. It challenges all of his guys, and I think he's going to challenge Jared. So the good Jared Cook, which is what? When he's been healthy, And when he's played with a lot of focus, has been a really good, a high-graded tight end in this league. He hasn't been healthy enough, and hasn't been consistent enough. And so that is a fair question and criticism. But that's the answer as to why he's been with so many teams. I will say this, that he's gotten some pretty good contract offers, which shows that there's some teams that are really interested and really you see the upside value with them. So we shall see. Jacob also asks a good question. Why has Stanford been more successful recruiting than other schools with similar standards for admission? Duke, Northwestern, Vanderbilt, Tulane. Very simply, the state of California. They have the state of California to choose from. Now, kids that go to Duke, Northwestern, Vanderbilt, Tulane, they recruit nationally as well. Stanford recruits nationally. So I think nationally, Stanford has a brand that's probably a bigger brand nationally than I think Stanford, Duke, Northwestern. A couple of things that come to mind. Stanford and Duke and Northwestern, in that order, have obviously great academics, but they have more majors to choose from, meaning you got a lot more opportunities if you're a good student. See, a lot of times these really good students want to specialize in a certain field, and Stanford and Duke and Northwestern, in that order, Stanford being the best, has more majors and programs than others. So they fit. You go to Vanderbilt, you don't want to go to med school. They just don't have a large, broad-based curriculum that is the case. Now, Stanford's in the Pac-12. Northwestern's in the Big Ten. Duke's in the ACC. Vanderbilt's in the SEC. You meant Tulane. Well, Tulane is not a big-time football program. Tulane is not in a big-time conference. So Tulane doesn't really fit with the others. But as it relates to Duke and Northwestern and Vanderbilt, Stanford, in addition to being national recruiting entities like those others, Stanford has the state of California to recruit from. So if you're a kid from California and you're going to school, even if you don't have a scholarship or partial scholarships, it's a lot cheaper, obviously, if you're in the state of California, living there, to, the in-state schooling is a little cheaper than out of state, and those things have an impact, and you have a lot more kids to choose from in the state of California. And the public school system in California is very, very good, high school. So there are a lot of quality, very bright students that are in your state more than they're in the state of Illinois and North Carolina or Tennessee. It just is. So the others have to recruit more nationally. Stanford recruits a lot in-state, but they do get a lot of national students as well. So they've got a larger pool because of in-state. They've got a broader-based curriculum in which more kids can do, study more things, and that's been the big part of it. The other thing is they have put more emphasis on on athletics at Stanford as a whole than any other. We know Duke basketball has been emphasized. Vanderbilt does a very poor job of emphasizing athletics. Of that group, Vanderbilt does a very poor job with facilities, and they don't put the emphasis on athletics, which is fine, but it is not very impressive as a student athlete to go to Vanderbilt unless if you're looking at, if location doesn't matter, you're not from that area, you go look at Vanderbilt, and that's not all that impressive. Northwestern, with their football facilities, has made some inroads, and they put together a tremendous facility that's going to help them. But they've been behind in the past. Duke doesn't have great football facilities, obviously basketball. Stanford is more well-rounded. They don't have posh athletic facilities, but they're really good. And again, it is the location of the area is much more appealing to most people. The Northern California, particularly for the people out west, very, very appealing. Rural North Carolina, you have to really be there and really like what you're getting there at Duke. Nashville's a great place, but again, not on the same level in terms of facilities. And Northwestern, it's great if you like Chicago, you're from that area, it's just not for everybody. So you factor in those other things, that's what makes Stanford, they're a little bit more appealing in terms of what they can offer you. So hope that answers your question there. All right. Quarterback. There's not a more high-profile job in all of sports than playing quarterback. It's the most important position on the field in any sport. It's much bigger than the arm strength, the ability to throw a tight spiral. And it's really what happens before the moment the quarterback releases the ball. That's what's most important. That's what determines the ultimate success. The touchdown brings the cheers, but it's the ability to process tremendous amount of information that makes the touchdown possible. And that's where quarterbacking is different than I think people think. Let's talk a little bit about the preparation time. For a pro quarterback, the job begins early in the week than any other player, and that is Monday. For a college guy, not as much as expected, but you better believe that guy better come in on Sunday and do the same thing that NFL guys do on Monday to a certain degree. you got to really know. By the time the rest of the team comes in on Wednesday for an NFL game plan or Tuesday for a college game plan, that quarterback has already absorbed the game plan. He better know it from Monday and Tuesday if you're an NFL guy, or Sunday and Monday from a college guy. He's based upon his looking at film and looking at cut-ups with his coordinator. He will have shared with his coaches what he's comfortable with, what some things that he's seeing, not trying to do the job of the coach, but trying to tell the coach what he's comfortable with, what he feels best about running and executing. You can have a good game plan that allows you to best attack an opponent, but if you can't execute it, doesn't really matter. So it's really important to understand, pardon me, what is the best come game day. And then you fine-tune the plan. You work with that coach during the week. You work through game plan day. You go through practice. After each practice, you'll spend time maybe a little bit before meeting with the coaches as a team. You'll sit there with your coordinator, your quarterback coach, and you go over what went well at practice. In other words, you go over the mistakes and the positives from practice the previous day, but also kind of why. Okay, what are you struggling with here? You're struggling with this read. You're struggling with this protection. And if it's something the guy's not really comfortable with, you got to get him comfortable, but you also need to kind of move away from it to something he's more comfortable with. So you go through that process of siphoning out what the do's and don'ts of that position. By the time you get through the Friday practice, the quarterback's been very, very involved. Thursday practice for the college guy. Quarterback's really involved in shaping the game plan because it's what he can execute. What you want to call is one thing. What you can execute comes down to the quarterback. So he's going to have an intimate knowledge of everybody's responsibility in his offense. Over the course of the work week, the offense, for example, will have practiced every conceivable down and distance situation they could possibly face. Coaches have watched enough film of the opposing defense to have a sense of what their tendencies are going to be in various situations. They determine with the quarterback the four or five plays that field could work at a given down and distance. So on game day, the quarterback and coaches are going to be in agreement on which plays are going to work on, say, second and five, third and two, third and long, et cetera. The game plan takes shape after compiling play calling options, which include potential audibles for every down and distance, additional contingencies made for the score, time remaining, field position, the weather condition, various other mitigating factors. If merely retaining all this information were the only responsibility, it'd be tough enough. Okay, but there's no shortage of contingencies and considerations that a quarterback has to pay attention to and be prepared for. So quarterback has to understand how every conceivable factor will affect the offense well before he comes charging out of the tunnel on Sunday. Okay, so now you've got a little bit of a sense overview of what it's like during the week. Now you're getting into the game. You're out of the tunnel. Okay, now you got to call a play. So all the tactical preparation gets put to test on game day. And then this comes to fire under full speed. So on the field, the quarterback's real job begins the instant the play ends, the previous play ends, and the clock starts counting out to the snap of the next. It begins in the huddle where a quarterback calls the play sent in by the coaches. Very rarely do you have quarterbacks going to call their game like in the old days. So he usually gets the message in today's game through the earpiece in his helmet. When you see him looking to the sideline, he's looking to see what personnel is coming onto the field. There's a personnel coach, one of the assistant coaches that's responsible for getting the right person, sending the right players into the game. But it's incumbent upon the quarterback to confirm that and also pay attention to who the specific personnel is. You know, when you see an injury out there, you think, oh, man, the tight end went down. Oh, quarterback has to know that. We lost our starting tight end on the last series. He's not ready to come back in the game. The quarterback has to ask the backup tight end, are you comfortable with this? Maybe even have to coach him up from an assignment standpoint a little bit more because he didn't get as many reps in running the play. So you've got to be very well in the personnel grouping, and that's why they're looking to the sideline to see who's coming in. In making the determination of who he needs to school up, who he needs to make an adjustment to. All right. Let's say now the play actually is called. First, the play call provides a formation declaration. Okay. So what does that really mean? It tells everyone where to line up. So let's say it's 21 personnel. 21 personnel, two backs and one tight end. When you hear 21 personnel, 12 personnel, 22 personnel, the first number refers to the number of running backs. The second number refers to the number of tight ends. Okay, so let's say it's 21 personnel, two backs, one tight end, which means what? There's two receivers. The number has to add up to five, okay? Because you got five offensive linemen and a quarterback. So when you give the number 21 personnel, it adds up to five because 21 is three, two backs, one tight end, and the remaining number is the number of receivers. So if you have an empty set, you might have five receivers. If you've got one back, you've got 10 personnel, that's one back, no tight ends, four receivers. 11 personnel, one back, one tight end, three receivers. So the numbers add up to five. Let's say it's 21 personnel, two backs, one tight end, two receivers, right? And the call is I weak right. The I tells the tailback that he's 6.5 yards behind the quarterback. The weak in the I weak right tells the fullback that he's offset in the B gap to the weak side, which is the side opposite of the tight end. On this play, the tight end will line up right. Okay, tailback 6.5 yards behind the quarterback. Weak, the fullback, and again, two backs, is offset in the B gap to the weak side. Right is the tight end lines up on the right. So the weak side is the left side on this call. Okay, so now you know, I weak right tells you where the run the halfback, the tailback, the fullback, and the tight end are lined up. With only one tight end on the field, the X receiver will be the split end of the weak side. The Z receiver lines up at flanker. The Z is the flanker on the tight end side. So you automatically know that. The X and Z receiver, in these cases, know what they are. The split end is on the side opposite the tight end. The Z is on the side, the flanker is on the side to the tight end. So The tight end's on the right side. The flanker's on the right side off the line of scrimmage. Because he can't cover up the tight end. He has to be off the line of scrimmage. Technically, the flanker's in the backfield. The split end is on the line of scrimmage on the left side. Side opposite the tight end. So there you go. I, weak right, lines up five players. That's one example. Then the play call dictates a run or a pass. On a run, the play will communicate which hole is the point of attack. In a traditional numbering system, the holes on the right side are even and the ones on the left are odd. The numbers increase as you move out towards the sideline, which means the hole between the center and the left guard is one. The hole between the left guard and left tackle is three. The hole between the center and right guard is two, so on and so forth. In addition, each member of the backfield has his own number. The quarterback is one, the tailback is two, the fullback is three. A 25 zone then would call for the tailback, which is number two, to attack the five hole, that's the outside of the left tackle. The receivers get their route information from the play call too. The passing tree was, the numbering system was conceived by the great Don Coryell. And every route is assigned a number. A quarterback will call his receiver's routes from left to right across the formation. So a play called I weak right, you know what that means, right? You know everybody's lined up. I weak right, 8-19, would have the X receiver running an 8 route, which is a pulse. The Y receiver in this formation, the tight end, is running a 1, a quick out. And the Z receiver is running a 9 route, a fly route, a go route. So I weak right, 8-1-9. You know where the backs line up, the receivers line up, the tight ends line up, the fullbacks line up, and you know which route's running. Okay? All in the call. I weak right, 8-19. Okay? Now, if a running back is going to be added into the pattern, the route will be declared verbally instead of numerically. So to have the fullback release through the line and work opposite his alignment, the call would be, I weak right, 8-19, fullback opposite. Throw in a bootleg by the quarterback and you have I weak right, boot right, 8-1-9, fullback opposite. Okay? So now, I weak right, you know what that is. 8-1-9, you know what that is. Fullback opposite, okay? You know what that is. Now you got I weak right, boot right, 8-1-9, fullback opposite. Tells everybody what to do, where to go. If you want the split end to try to run a corner pattern, the tight end to run a curl in the middle of the field, and the Z to run a post, and the tailback to run a swing route, what would you run? Think about it. You want the split end to run a corner pattern, the tight end to run a curl in the middle of the field, and a Z to run a post, the tailback to run a swing route. You'd call 7-6-8 tailback swing, right? Okay, you give the definition of the routes on the route tree. And let me explain the route tree real quick. The zero route is the quick slant. The one route is the quick out. The two route is a stop route. The three route is about 12 yards up and then out. The four route is the dig route. The five route is the curl in and curl out. The five route is the curl out. The 6 route is the curl in. The 7 route is the corner route. The 8 route is the post route. And the 9 route is the fly route. So you know the numbers of the passing tree. That's where you determine where the receivers are going to go. And you add some stuff to it. Now, this is, in a general sense, how people like to do it. There's differences and variations. For instance, West Coast terminology is different, at least in regards to the passing game. Coaches like their quarterbacks to call out every route by name. So the play that we just did would be I weak right, X fly, Y stop, Z curl, fullback free. That's a lot of verbiage in a short period of time. So I think it just creates more opportunities for a mistake. I like fewer numbers. John Gruden always preferred, for example, where you'd run a 939 out of an I formation would be 9 route, a 3 route, and a 9 route by three guys going out into the pattern. You know, a guy like Gruden would say, shift to I, Z motion, strong curl, flat swing. That's a lot to get in, particularly when the clock's running down. And it's part of the reason why a guy like Gruden always struggled with developing young quarterbacks. It's too much verbiage, and it's a problem. He's the Rich Gannons, the Brad Johnsons of the world, it's fine. But you ask that when you try to break the huddle and you get to the line of 15 seconds to play and you got to do all that. Imagine that. You got something you want to say, and you can say it very well, and you know what it is, but your mouth is going faster than your brain because you got to be real – quick. It's a lot more difficult. So it is one of the reasons why the veteran quarterbacks have worked best with Gruden. So you needed someone that could handle the language of the offense, and never mind the execution of it as well. And so it's a big issue. All right. What I want to get into on Thursday is the mental phase of the pre-snap read. I want to go into the pre-snap rate. I've taken you through calling a play, and obviously there are a million plays, but you understand a couple of ways you're going to do. You're either going to describe the route, you're going to describe the run, or you're going to call it out in the numbering system, which I've given you. So now you know how to call a play. You know what the numbering system are for the positions. You know the numbering situations to enter the hole. You know the numbering situations for the route. So you know it. You know what the personnel groupings are. So you know how to call a play. So you can decide kind of what you want and call a play. You play quarterback. We will like to take it a little bit, little bit by little bit by little bit. Let me give you an example. Let's go back to that I weak right, boot right, 8-1-9 fullback opposite. So the first thing you need to know, in an I formation, the running back sets up 6.5 yards behind the line of scrimmage. Weak sends the fullback to the B gap, right? The side opposite from the tight end. The tight end goes to the declared side, right? The Z receiver stays on the strong side. The X receiver lines up to the weak side. Boot right tells the lineman which way the quarterback is going to be moving. 8-1-9 directs the receivers from left to right. X runs the 8 route, which is a post route. The Y receiver in this formation is the tight end, runs a 1, which is a quick out. And the Z runs a 9, the fly route. Fullback opposite tells the fullback to release through the line and then work opposite his alignment. So that gives you an explanation of that call. If you got any questions, send it to me. We'll address it on Thursday's podcast on this. We're going to go a little bit about go answer your questions, and then we're going to take you through the pre-snap read, the mental phase of the pre-snap read. You've got the play call. Now you go into the line of scrimmage with the pre-snap read. We're going to talk about making some adjustments, what you're seeing. You know how to call a play. Now you got to go there and make that adjustment and understand what you're seeing. Make sure that everybody sees it. Hope you get a little bit of an idea that, that dumb quarterback can't do this or that. It's a little bit more complicated. And, people will talk about the physical part of the game and, well, I wasn't good enough to do that, but, I'm smart, I can do this, that. There's a different smart. There's a different level of smart of understanding this and being able to absorb it, one, and executed in the live action of the moment. Hope you get a better appreciation for this as we go through it. So we'll take you through that mental phase of the pre-snap read on Thursday's podcast and answer your questions. We appreciate you joining us today as we do have you welcome us into your homes, place of businesses, whatever, car. We appreciate you watching, listening for us and watching out for us at LandryFootball.com. So check us out for all the latest in the world of college football, the NFL, our daily notebooks, our film room breakdowns. That's what we do for you at LandryFootball.com, and catch all of our podcasts here free at LandryFootball.com. So we'll see you, talk to you rather, on Thursday. We'll continue with our X's and O's series and keep you up to date on everything going on around the world of college football and the NFL. Any questions, send it over to us at LandryFootball.com. Appreciate you joining us. Talk to you again next time, everybody.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at Landry Football. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is a crush performance with Jeff Crichel Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
One of our themes in 2019 is organizational performance. Looking at cultures, environments, what do successful organizations do to be successful? How do you tap into the potential of your employees or your athletes or your students so they can be their best, so your organization can be your best? How do you create performance cultures? Well, today I'm really excited. We'll be talking with John Gordon. You can go to johngordon.com. That's johngordon.com. He is an author. He's a speaker. He is a consultant and thought leader when it comes to organizational performance, cultures, developing leadership. I actually met John this spring down at the Texas Rangers spring training, and it was a fantastic experience for me looking at that organization and hearing John send his message into an organization that's not just talking about this kind of an approach, but they're actually implementing it. They're definitely a crush team to watch this season and beyond, because they're doing some special things there, and getting to see John in action and all the great leadership going on inside of that organization was a real treat. So I'm really looking forward to talking to John today about organizational performance, developing cultures, and providing environments where people can really, really tap into their potential.
Crush Performance with Jeff Crichel can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.